Okay, so thank you very much for coming this evening, which to what I know is going to be a very stimulating talk and conversation. This lecture is part of a series organised jointly by the Health Experiences Institute and the Management in Medicine programme here at Green Templeton College. My name is Sue Dobson, I'm a fellow here. I'm very delighted to chair this session. And Dr. Michael Maccabee, what can we say about your work? It's a long list of really important, influential publications in the area of leadership. Michael is an anthropologist and a psychoanalyst. He's globally recognised as an expert on leadership. He's president of the Maccabee Group in Washington and director of the Project on Technology, Work and Character, a non-for-profit research organisation. So for over 35 years, Dr. Maccabee has been consulting and coached to leaders, corporations and unions, universities, and a whole host of organisations. And he became internationally known for his books on leadership and his pioneering projects to improve the workplace. His article, Narcissistic Leaders, The Incredible Pros and Inevitable Cons, won a McKinsey Award in 2000 and was recognised as one of the most influential management articles. And indeed, his work is consistently shaping both the theory of leadership but also importantly, the practice of leadership, as many of us use his work as we seek to work in the executive education space. So we're delighted that you're here this evening. We're making you work very hard in the next few days because he's also working on an executive education course in the business school. But tonight he's here to talk to us about the leaders we need for healthcare. Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, let me say, I hope very much that this talk can be useful to you. I know there is a big difference between the National Health Service and healthcare organizations in the United States, though there is a huge variation in our healthcare system, and I believe all of us have the same goal of improving the patient care and the patient experience while decreasing costs and improving population health. I think that's the same challenge. Now, you have a huge challenge, the Nicholson Challenge, the National Health Service, and so this is a time, I know, of real stress within NHS. I picked up the Financial Times this morning. There's a quote by Stephen Dorrell, chairman of the Health Select Committee, about this productivity challenge. He said, "This is a management challenge, I think, almost literally without precedent in the history of managing large organizations anywhere on the planet." So we have a huge challenge. And in the United States also, we must deal with the cost of health care, which is now, I think, over 17% of GNP in the United States. And it's, in Britain, I think it's now 25% of the budget, of the national budget. However, the lessons that I've learned with my colleagues who are here, Cliff and Jane Norman. Please wave to the crowd. Cliff and Jane and I have just finished a manuscript on transforming healthcare leadership, a systems guide for improving care, decreasing costs, and improving population health. But they've worked with healthcare organizations not only in the United States, but Canada, they're in Singapore, Sweden, and when they leave here, they're working with the National Health Service here. And I think what we have seen is that there are certain principles that are applicable. And what I would like to, and I think also I've read the King's Fund report on leadership engagement for improvement in NHS, and what we see is, I think, consistent with that also. What I plan to talk about are three things. One, I want to give you a background of how I came to this from 35 years of consulting to large businesses working in 30 different countries, and how that led to studying and working with healthcare organizations and seeing a vision of where healthcare organizations need to do to transform a mode of production that has gone from a craft mode of production to a bureaucratic mode of production and needs to be transformed to what the most advanced knowledge organizations in the world are, and learning organizations, and I'll say something about that. And third, the kind of leadership required to do this, the qualities of mind and heart that are required from leaders who are going to make this happen. I started out working with business. I was, as Sue Dobson mentioned, I was trained as a psychoanalyst and anthropologist. I was an undergraduate here half a century ago at New College, and was in a anthropology seminar with Evans Pritchard, so that's how long ago my relationship with Oxford. But when I began to work with organizations was from the point of view of seeing that at that point in the 70s, that the Tayloristic system that was prevalent in factories were making workers into parts of the machine, were leading to alienation, being turned off. And I started a project in the United States bringing together the auto workers and an auto parts company on humanizing the workplace, getting workers involved. It was very successful. I was invited by Volvo to help them in Sweden. I then started a project in Scotland with Tannoy and was then the General Municipal Workers Union that led to cutting productivity improving productivity in a factory I think about 400 workers to 150 workers with higher quality. And I learned a lot of things from that. But I learned that you don't get change without visionary leaders. That I had to find leaders to work with who had those values, that kind of vision, that they could transform work. The factory work changed in the 80s. Dr. W. Edwards Deming was one of the people who was the visionary who started out in Japan and led to a transformation of the factory system with total quality management. Toyota was a leader in that, but the whole idea that workers could give wisdom to the machine of constant innovation. I remember visiting the Toyota factory in Nagoya and finding that one of the supervisors showed me that his workers produced on the average 50 ideas per worker per year, of which 82% were adopted. I thought that was impossible. And he said to me, "Well, you in the West have a different view of ideas than we do in Japan. So you think, you give surveys, and you're very pleased when 80 or 90% of the workers are satisfied. Then you think it's great. For us, every dissatisfaction is an opportunity for improvement. We want to see whatever it is, whether it's the lighting is bad or equipment is misplaced or so on. And we we take these ideas every week. We give people points, and we recognize a value of constant innovation because we have a purpose of creating quality for the customer, and we need the values, including values of leadership. It's very interesting to me. In the West, people would promote the best worker to be a manager. In Toyota, they look for the worker who taught other people, who created harmony, who created collaboration. That was the person who was promoted. Totally different way of thinking. In the 80s and 90s, I started to work for companies like AT&T in the United States and ABB, which is the electrical engineering company created by Swedes, Swiss, and Germans. And I began to see a whole new mode of production. And that had to do with knowledge work. For example, I was working with ABB in Canada, and their products were all becoming commodities, and the margins were disappearing. And so what we did was interview the major customers and said, what do you really need? And the largest ink producing company in the world, Cominco in Western Canada, said, you know, if you're really serious, we don't want to buy a power transformer from you. We'd have to go through a bidding process and so on. If you can sell us cheaper, cleaner energy, we'll partner with you to create that. And that was a model I began to see everywhere. Companies like IBM, who have been in the forefront of that, began to see that in the service, professional service knowledge area, productivity does not come just by the producer producing the best quality product. It comes in the relationship with the customer and the producer. And think about it. Productivity of an accountant is greater if the customer keeps good records. Productivity of a lawyer is greater if the customer gives all the information beforehand. Productivity of a physician is going to be a lot greater if the patient manages their own chronic conditions, such as diabetes or congestive heart failure or asthma. These are not things, productivity does not depend on the producer alone. And as I began to see that in a number of companies, I began to see that we were really moving in knowledge work, which is the most value creating work today globally. We were moving to a totally different mode of production with different tools, internet, information technology, different types of relationships, where, for example, IBM will not sell a product, it sells a solution. The products are part of a solution, and they will bring in products from other producers if necessary. So that they will say to a customer, what do we need to do to improve your traffic in your city? What do we need to do to improve the productivity in your office? And they have to bring together different specialists across disciplines who have to work together, which need a different kind of leadership, including the ability of leadership of many people within the team, because they're not hierarchies anymore, they're heterarchies, where leadership shifts according to who has the particular knowledge at the time. Is it the person who's analyzing the productivity problem, or is it the person bringing in the information systems, or is it the person bringing in products? This is a historic shift in production and logic of production. Let me just point out, if we look at the last couple of centuries, we can see the movement from the farming craft mode of production to the industrial bureaucratic mode of production to what I call the knowledge interactive mode of production. In the United States in 1870, 70% of people were working either on farms or small craft shops. Today, over 80% are in service work. The same is true for Britain. And the most advanced, the most value-creating of that service work is knowledge service work, which probably everyone in this room is involved in. So we are seeing a shift in what creates the highest productivity and value. Now, if we put this in terms of healthcare, what we see is a change in organization, the role of the physician, the relationship with the patient, and there is a threat in this shift. In the craft mode of production, physicians, which have been traditional, you have very strong values of care, of expertise. The danger of autonomy, the danger is you move from the craft to the bureaucratic. And that's happening a lot of places where physicians are told you only have 15 minutes with a patient, where patients can't develop a trusting relationship with any physician because they're pushed around to others. So much of what cures has to do with a transferential relationship with a physician someone trusts, where you develop a relationship and so on. This is all destroyed within a bureaucratic industrial framework. So the question is, how do we move from here to here? And this is a very different business model. We see differences in technology. We see difference in quality and cost control, from peer review to just standards, just a industrial model, to continuous improvement and innovation, kind of process change that my colleagues have been teaching in many parts of the world, where you both improve care and cost. It's not a matter of just adding money and people. It's a matter of transformation of the whole mode of thinking. And I'll say more about that later. And the whole model of care shifts from the biomedical to the biopsychosocial and epidemiological, because we're dealing with communities, we're dealing with the population, we're dealing with taking the learning that comes from the learning organization and transforming that into prevention, and I'll say some more about that later, where we've seen that happen. Physician skills have to change. Physician has to become more of a leader, a mentor. Leadership model changes the values. We want to maintain the best craft values within the knowledge interactive world. So that's the model. Now, how did that model come to? Well, it came to because, now, I had clinical experience of 30 years as practicing psychoanalysis and also being a training analyst and teacher and professor at the Washington School of Psychiatry. But I had not gotten involved with this whole question of healthcare until a very visionary leader, Henry Simmons, a physician who had been also in charge of quality back in the Nixon administration way back, came to me and he said, I'm told that you could help me. I said, how? He said, I'm told you're a good facilitator and I need facilitation. I'm putting together a commission on healthcare made up of very distinguished people from politics, corporations, editor of New England Journal of Medicine, a whole group of very distinguished, a commission on healthcare. And I need help to find out what these people would agree on. Well, we began, and for 12 years, we grew from a commission into a coalition of 100 members, including corporations, unions, pension funds, physician organizations, all the religious organizations. And I facilitated a process where we came out with what are the design criteria of a healthcare system, which led to our law, new law, the Affordable Care Act. And those five elements that we saw as a system is interacting with each other, including universal care, quality, which had to do both with patient satisfaction and also quality in terms of safety and other measurements, cost control, equitable financing, and administrative simplification. Now, the Affordable Care Act is far from creating all that, but it is the beginning. It's a platform. And with visionary leaders like Don Berwick, who started out helping to get it started, we have good models. We're showing what's possible. And I'm still working, I'm still on the board of the coalition working to lobby to control costs without cutting quality. Because there are two ways to control costs. One is the bureaucratic way of slicing, and the other is the learning knowledge way of changing organizations so they are more, you're improving the whole process, and you're understanding the organization as a system. And I would say some more on that, because that's a major problem of understanding organizations as systems. Now, this model came about because here I was, I had experience working as a clinician, and I had experience working up on policy, but I felt I didn't really understand what was going on in the organizations that were doing healthcare. So I felt very frustrated. How does this work itself out? And I got together with two classmates, old classmates of mine who were now distinguished physicians. One, Roger Boulder, was then president of the Association of Academic Health Centers in the United States. The other, Paul Greiner, had just retired as the chief executive of Strong Memorial Hospital in Rochester, which was really one of the most innovative, created some of the best development of what we're talking about. And we got together and worked out this model on the basis of what I knew and what they knew. And then we tested it out with heads of the academic health centers in the country. I tested this out and gave them a gap survey on the elements of it, and we saw a real gap. And they got up and they said, this is where we need to go. This is exactly where we need to go. And I got a grant then from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation to go study 15 of the best healthcare organizations in the United States, and in depth. And what I found were some important differences, but moving in a certain direction. So you have the difference between Intermountain Healthcare and Salt Lake City, Utah, which studied, the Dartmouth Institute studied and said, if everybody did what Intermountain's doing in the United States, it would immediately cut 30% of the cost of healthcare, improving quality. I mean, they had started out using informatics and bringing together teams of physicians, nurses, administrators to find pathways and teach patients to manage their own diseases and create partnerships with companies to do this, showing that they both decreased cost and improved productivity. The patients got better, they were educated, et cetera. And then places like the Mayo Clinic, which is a model that copied by a number of other healthcare organizations like Geisinger in Pennsylvania, Cleveland Clinic in Ohio. These are organizations built on the idea of the interactive model of physicians who work together with a whole patient's problem, not what I saw in most academic health centers, where patient service came third after research, which got the grants, and teaching. Mayo is the only academic health center I found where the patient comes first, care comes first, and all the research is clinical. And they've won Nobel Prizes, but it's clinical research, not looking at basic research and trying to get big grants for that. So, and every place I went, I used the model I've just shown you and a gap survey. And I asked them, is this where you want to be? And where are you now? And how do you close those gaps? How do you begin to look at those gaps? So what I'm showing you is a theoretical model, but doesn't come out of thin air or out of my head. It comes in a very intensive work, starting with physicians who have a deep desire to not get stuck in a bureaucratic world and not lose the best of medicine and the tradition and the spirit of why they went into that field. The major gaps I found was patient service is the highest priority, utilization management is shared by all physicians, huge variabilities in practice. Information systems support physician decision making. Many of the information systems coming in just supported the billing system. Leaders develop a relation of trust. It's very interesting. There's a new book that's come out by one of the professors at Kennedy School at Harvard. And what her thesis is, we have a huge trust problem with leadership. We know that. The Kennedy School survey shows 80% of the American public don't trust their leaders. And I'm sure it's the same everywhere. And what she says is, since we started to distrust our leaders, we've had a huge development of leadership training, of which we are a part.
Very grateful.
And she said, the result has been even more distrust. What does that say about what we've been doing? We can come back to that later. But I think it's a very relevant point, because one thing that I have found and deeply learned, and start out with, is leadership alone doesn't cut it. We're talking about system change. Leaders are one part of it, and it's not the leader. It's a system of leadership throughout an organization, and if you don't have the processes, you don't have the philosophy, you don't have the values, leadership alone is nothing. What I found as I looked at most of these academic health centers were like feudal castles, where you had the feudal lord was the head of the organization, and the chairs were the vassals, and then there were the serfs were the local MDs around there who sent their tribute up to the castle and were in turn treated with great disrespect by the specialists, or we had bureaucracies with a lot of resistance by the craft physicians. I remember we had a seminar in Stockholm And one of the people there was the chief executive of the Danderyd, one of the best hospitals in Sweden. And she got up and said, she is a physician, and she said, what I've learned is physicians will only follow a physician. But when a physician becomes the hospital chief executive, she's no longer considered a physician. So a member of the University of Michigan, one of the chairs said to me, well, one of the chairs went over to be head of the hospital. He's gone over to the dark side. So what I found everywhere, this conflict between the physician and the physician's logic of the individual, the patient, and the bureaucratic logic of the hospital and so on, which is only going to be resolved if you can create a learning organization. Now, what I've been seeing, though, are different, very, very promising models. And I mentioned the Mayo and Intermountain. Kaiser Permanente is another that are moving in this direction. And they're coming from different directions. But for example, Intermountain now has a Brent James, who's been one of the great leaders in the idea of using informatics to make clinical pathways and so on, has organized a consortium, a learning consortium, including Mayo, Intermountain, UCLA, Cleveland Clinic, and when they develop a new surgical form, he was talking about a new knee operation, they share it together. Once they have a new pathway that works, they put it on the internet, so if a physician is going to do a certain kind of operation or procedure, they see what the pathway is, they don't have to use it. If they want to deviate from it because the patient's different, then they put in what they learned, what they saw, and then the people discuss together, should we change the pathway or is this just something, a special case, not a common form of looking at variability. So, but another model, which is extremely promising, is started by insurers, Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Michigan. Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Michigan, with very creative, two creative physicians, started a project where they began to incentivize healthcare organizations to become integrated systems, to become clinical families for the population. And they don't incentivize individuals, they incentivize the organization. The more, and they measure their quality, their cost, and everything has improved, incredibly improved over the past few years. And now they're dealing with 5 million patients in Michigan with incredible results due to, and every twice a year, all of these different 90 healthcare organizations meet together, share their learning, and innovation, and those who have cut costs and improved quality and so on, get the insurance company gives them an incentive to do more research, more development, more training. It's a great model. They have 2,500 primary care and specialists in 770 units with 5 million people. Now, The leader who started this, David Scher, I talked to him on the phone, and he had said, he had given testimony before Congress, and he said, I quote, lack of systems understanding is the root cause of poor cost and quality performance. I repeat that. Lack of systems understanding. Now, what is a system? What is a system? A system is a collection of interdependent elements that work interactively to further the purpose of a system. And by the way, systems often need to adapt to larger systems. Russell Lakoff, who is a profound writer about systems thinking, who I worked with, Professor at Wharton, wrote a wonderful book called Creating the Corporate Future, which I highly recommend everyone to read. He used to say, we need to distinguish between three kinds of systems: mechanical systems, organic systems, and social systems. Mechanical system is something you can design, like a car. An organic system is genetically determined, like the human body. So you can determine the purpose of a mechanical system, car, for example, and say the purpose is transportation, or transportation with using more efficient use of fuel, etc. Organic system is genetically determined, the purpose is life. But if we look at a social system, the parts of a social system are people who all have their own purposes. So how do you create a system with a common purpose? Becomes a basic challenge of any organization that sees itself as a system. And let me say, by the way, when you don't understand the system, for example, Acuff used to give the example, if I said to a group of people, we're gonna make the greatest car in the world, and I want you to find the best engine in the world, and you the best drivetrain, you the best braking system. One person came with a Ferrari, another with a Mercedes, another with a Lexus piece. We put it together, what will we have? Junk. Yeah. How many organizations say we're going to have the best department of radiology, we're going to have the best department of surgery, we're going to have the best HR department, we're going to have the best administration? And they think they're creating a system. So if we don't start there, we get nowhere. And that's a very different way of thinking from bureaucracies or craft organizations. What I've also discovered, if you're going to create a social system, you have to have a leadership philosophy. And a philosophy, William Mayo had a philosophy, that's how he created the Mayo Clinic. Philosophy has a purpose, case of Mayo with the patient. It has practical values necessary to achieve that purpose. Not kind of general values, practical values that are really practiced to meet that purpose. I first learned this, by the way, when I studied Hewlett-Packard way back in the 70s, and I had a discussion with Bill Hewlett. I said to him, what is the purpose of HP? He said, the purpose of HP is to make instruments that help engineers do their job better. I said, how do you do that? He said, we have certain values. For example, we have collaboration between the developers who go out and study what the customers need, what the engineers need. They come together and meet with the manufacturers and the marketing people who set the prices and so on. And we also have the highest excellence. If anyone wants to go back to Stanford and improve their education, their quality, we pay for that. We also believe in loyalty, and we don't lay off anyone when there's a downturn in business. We take off one day a week and cut salary 20% from me to the everyone in the organization, and we believe in constant development ideas, so we want entrepreneurs here. So I said, well, if you want entrepreneurs, they're going to leave. They're going to start their own companies. He said, I know that. But because they've been treated so well here, they're going to be our customers and our suppliers. And that created Silicon Valley. Apple Computer came out of HP. Many of the other companies came out of HP. A philosophy. A philosophy has a purpose. Practical values to meet that purpose, a view of moral and ethical reasoning that directs decisions. Are we just looking out for ourselves? Are we looking out for a larger stakeholders community? And finally, a definition of results that is consistent with the purpose. Now, Peter Drucker once said, the purpose of business is not to make a profit, just as the purpose of life is not breathing. However, without either one, you can have no other purpose. So be realistic. Profit is important, central, but it's not the purpose. And Drucker said, the only legitimate purpose of a business is to gain and retain customers. How you do that really determines who you are and your purpose. So the leaders we need, what we found, they're not the kind of leaders I saw. They're not the ombudsman for the doctors. They're not the caring facilitator who just lets everybody have a say. They're not the narcissistic visionaries who don't listen. I remember I was trying to coach a visionary narcissistic CEO of a huge healthcare system. And we were sitting there with the vice presidents and all the important people, and they were trying to tell him that what he was saying was not going to work. And he just ignored them. So finally, we had a coffee break. I turned to him. I said, you're not listening. And he looked at me and he said, I didn't get here by listening to other people. That was true. He also got fired because he didn't listen to other people. Those were true. So we don't need that kind of person or the kind of dictator I met. I was once asked to look at a factory and to see whether they were ripe for development and improvement in management. And the factory manager took me around, and it was a very new factory, but he had read all these kinds of books on management, and he had enriched the jobs and done all these things, and he was very proud of it. And we went, going back to his office, I said, well, he said, anything more? I said, well, can I talk to some of the workers? Why would you want to do that? He said. I said, well, I'd just like to get their views. He said, well, talk to whoever you want and meet me back in the office. So I started talking to the workers. They were very frustrated. They said, we know ways to improve productivity. His stuff is really for the birds. We know suppliers who are cheaper. We know a lot of waste that's taking place. And he doesn't listen to anything, so we're turned off. So I went back to the office. He said, well, what did you say? What do you think? Well, I said, it's a very clean factory. I'm very impressed by your technology. But I do think you have a problem. He said, what's that? I said, I think you have a communications problem. He says, you got that right. I keep communicating to these people over and over how to do things right, and they don't get it. I said, well, I meant two ways. He said, of course I use two ways. I give talks and I write memos. Well, you laugh, but how many managers think that's the way to get people to understand? Well, I'm going to run out of time. But what we have found as we have studied and worked with organizations is they are full of myths, management myths that they're taught. And, you know, I like the quote attributed to Mark Twain, it ain't what you don't know that gets you into trouble. It's what you know for sure that just ain't so. And so as we look at the range, we see all kinds of myths of management that just aren't true. One, leaders are born, not made. What we see are very different kinds of leadership based on different kinds of personality and ability. And they all can learn how to be, to take leadership roles. That's what we see in the most advanced knowledge organizations, that leadership needs to shift. Everyone needs to have the ability to take a leadership position. Two, we get the best results by managing by the numbers versus understanding the causes. We just need to hold people accountable. This is one of the biggest myths of all, where Dr. Deming used to always show how this idea of holding people accountable, that most of the errors in organization are system errors. They're due to problems in the system. And they're not due to individuals. And it's called the attribution error. Well, sometimes things are due to individuals. But first, you need to look at the system. If you don't understand the system, you're not going to understand the errors. The best way to improve an organization is to improve each part. You know, we must use incentives to get people to change. Well, what we found, not to go into this, but I first learned that there is a famous fundamental study that was done by Professor Harry Harlow at the University of Wisconsin in the 40s. And he got monkeys, he taught monkeys, gave monkeys a problem to solve, opening a door and getting out and so on. And they learned and that improved. And then he started giving them bananas for getting it right, and their performance deteriorated. And we've seen that time and time again. When people are looking at the bananas rather than the problem, performance disappears. We did a little project this afternoon here in a workshop looking at what are the real motivating factors in people. There are five R's: responsibilities, relationships, recognition, rewards, which are the probably least important in any professional, and they came out the lowest, and reasons, which are often the most important, that you're doing something meaningful, worthwhile. And it's the old story they tell of the two stonemasons in the Middle Ages who are coming home from work, and one looks all beaten down and sad, and the other looks happy and full of joy. And somebody comes across him and says to the first, "Why are you so downtrodden and beaten?" He said, "I've been carrying huge stones all day." And he turns to the other, "What about you? Why do you look so happy?" He said, "I've been building a cathedral." So the question is, are we going to build cathedrals, or are we going to carry stones? And I could go on. I'm not going to. I'll leave you some motivation to get our book when it comes out. Final one I want to just mention, because this comes out all the time. I just read an article in The Economist saying the British system needs more competition. That's what will improve everything. Well, when Paul Greiner, who I mentioned, was in Rochester, he got all the hospitals in Rochester to agree that everyone would not try to buy all the technology and all the expensive capital, that they would specialize with different hospitals and share more together and so on. They did, and the cost went down, quality improved, people were focusing in different places more. And along came a new CEO of Kodak in Rochester, and he was on the board of Rochester University. He said, "This is terrible. I mean, competition is going to really improve things. Competition will improve quality and cost." Well, so they all started to compete. Everybody started to buy everything. All the prices went up. It was a disaster. I'm going to finish by saying we've looked at the qualities of that are needed by those who are going to really lead transformation in healthcare, who are going to really develop this. And we've seen something we call strategic intelligence, foresight, the ability to think systemically of a vision, the ability to partner with others, which is crucial in doing this, and the ability to create the processes of change and to motivate people to want to change and to learn from that. But, you know, none of this will work without people who combine head and heart, who combine knowledge, understanding with courage. Courage, the word courage, comes from the French, knowledge of the heart. And Samuel Johnson said, without courage, all the other values are worthless. So let me just end saying one thing. I'm talking about all the new kind of organization and leadership needed, but I always go back, the best definition of a good leader was written 2,500 years ago by Lao Tzu in China, who said the best of all leaders is the one who helps people so eventually they don't need him. Then comes the one they love and admire. Then comes the one they fear. Then comes the one who, the worst one is the one who lets people push him around. He's not a leader at all. People won't trust a leader who doesn't trust them. The best leader doesn't say a great deal, but everything he says is totally credible. And when he's finished with his work, the people say, we did it ourselves. Thank you.